Hello and welcome to another episode of I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. You can find me on Twitter as @ChrisShawEditor. The Egg Pods will take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by comedian, songwriter, and presenter of Matt Men, Politics Unboringed, and Unfinished London. He's currently on tour with his disgusting Songs for Revolting Kids show, Jay Foreman.
Hello, Chris.
Hello, Jay.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm delightful. How are you?
Oh, delightful. Wow, I can't live up to delightful. I'm merely fair to moderate. But it's a lovely sunny day out there, which I think is fitting for the album that we're going to discuss.
It is pop sunshine out there, and we are going to be talking about the epic masterpiece Revolver.
This is, I think, the sunniest album that they have, because two things. First of all, apparently it was released at the height of summer 1966, which is when Britain was at its most optimistic. England had just won the World Cup, and it was apparently an incredibly hot summer.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, if you look at the back of the album, they're all wearing sunglasses.
They are. It was a surreal. It was Carnaby Street. Jumpers with goalposts.
It was sort of everything apart from the album's front cover suggests it's bright, colourful and sunshiny.
The backdrop to this album, previously we'd had Rubber Soul, which was marijuana-soaked, autumnal, kind of soft acoustic album, but Revolver was something altogether more spiky.
Yeah, it was Rubber Soul. They experimented. They had a tiniest little bit of, let's see if we can do a song that's not about ladies. And that was Nowhere Man. It took them until 1965 to finally sing something that wasn't about love or loss or fancying someone. And then Revolver, one album later, there's barely any love songs on there. If you look at the subject matter for the songs, tax evasion, death, insomnia, all in 1 year.
It was, yeah.
And it was also, I think, is it fair to count Paperback Writer and Rain as albums from Revolver? Even though they weren't on the album, they were recorded and released at the same time.
Definitely.
So I'm going to throw those in. Is that all right?
I would say that they're equally as important as Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane as a prelude to Pepper.
And neither of those are about love either.
Exactly. In fact, the only love song is Here, There and Everywhere. That is literally the only love song on Revolver.
What about Love You Too from George?
Well, that's more about make love singing songs. That's kind of a bit odd.
I don't know. It's a bit unambiguous towards the end. He says, I'll make love to you, if you want me to.
Yeah.
That's if it's all right with you. Which is you contrast that with the kind of lyrics that John was writing at the same time. George was more woke.
He was woke.
Even though they're not on the album, what used to happen, I'm sure you've discussed this at length on this podcast before, but it was quite rare that the Beatles would release a single that you could also find on an LP, because they thought that was cheating the public. I mean, American record labels, they didn't mind at all. But over here, there was a lot of singles that could not be found on an album, and that includes Paperback Writer with the B-side Rain. And they're both great songs, and they could have made Revolver, you know, if you could imagine such a thing, even better than it already is.
That's one of those comments. What would you take off Revolver to include those? Tricky.
Well, I was thinking about this today because I listened to Revolver last night and this morning to revise. And I think I figured out what my least favourite song on the album is. But I'll save it until we start talking about it.
Yeah, let me do a nice, encouraging opening to it and you can just tear it to shreds.
Yeah. Oh, and you don't know which one it is.
I don't.
Could be any of them. I could tear any of the songs to shreds.
I'd say Rain was a kind of pointer towards what was about to come.
Yeah, because it had the backwards bit near the end. And that made it, I suppose, more interesting in terms of things you can do with a studio than Paperback Writer. It's difficult to pick a favourite between those two songs, the A-side and B-side. And I wonder why they chose Paperback Writer for the single and not Rain.
Mm. And Rain's quite heavy going, isn't it, for 1966 as a single?
Yeah. Probably the best place that you can hear the influence that the song Rain had is the Oasis song Up in the Sky.
Yes.
Which is almost identical. It's in the same key. It's got the same drone. You could almost sing one on top of the other.
Yeah, I think Rain is pretty well most of Oasis' career. I might delete that, depending on who's listening.
If we've got Liam and Noel Gallagher listening, hey guys!
Yep, you shine.
They might well be, because I've heard they're fans of the Beatles.
No.
Yeah?
Really? Oh, we've done Revolver now. They're going to have to do a Ringo album.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
Track one, Tax Man.
Yes. Yes, Tax Man. Now, that song was so influential that it spawned a genre. Songs that have the bass line from Taxman.
Yes. Which I think the Jam pretty well cornered.
Yeah. I mean, what the Jam with what you give is what you get. So it's so close to Taxman, it might as well be a cover. Did they acknowledge that, though? Did they actually say this song is very, very heavily based on Taxman?
Yeah, Paul Weller did a... I think Paul Weller's quote was, I've just been listening to a lot of Revolver, and that was left. That was it.
But I mean, was it declared on the small print of the record? Like, did it actually say the Beatles get a bit of money for this?
No, not
well,
at all.
I suppose that's fair, because George Harrison would go on to rip off someone else's song, My Sweet Lord. So, and also, he had plenty of money. He didn't. He was fine.
Well, not at this time. Hence, I think it was they were paying super tax, which was something like 96p in the pound at the time.
Well, we can work out exactly what it was with a bit of simple maths. He says, there's one for you, 19 for me.
There you go.
Suppose that means it's 95%.
That's pre-decimal, though. I don't do that.
Oh, of course, yeah. I do love the Beatles. I really do. And particularly George, but these are not his best lyrics. It's like he's having a whinge. Because 5% of a Beatles salary, he's still a millionaire.
Yeah.
And what's so terrible about paying tax to pay for all those lovely schools and hospitals?
Absolutely. What was he thinking?
He was probably just in a bad mood. I went less than a year ago. There was an exhibition in London run by Olivia Harrison, his most recent wife.
Mm.
Which had framed pictures on the wall of original George Harrison lyrics. And it's amazing because you can see all the crossings out and the changes. And they had Taxman up there.
Ah.
And the original draft of Taxman was even worse. It looks like the ramblings of a teenager. Well, of course, he was in his early 20s. He might as well have been a teenager. And he's saying, yeah, so give in to conformity, was one of the lines that
No, really?
Or better than cut.
Oh.
But, you know, lyrically it's terrible, but I can forgive it because musically, it's brilliant.
It is, yeah. And Paul's guitar solo is phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
Angry. Angry. Crunchy. More cowbell. More cowbell. There's some cowbell on here.
That's true. There's not a lot of Beatles songs that have cowbell.
No.
Or the ones that do aren't their best. So Don't Pass Me By, for example, is my least favourite Beatles song from their entire oeuvre. That's got cowbell.
It has, yeah. You've mentioned this before, but yeah, just briefly, what are your thoughts on that particular song?
On Don't Pass Me By?
Yeah.
Don't Pass Me By, it's written by Ringo. It's one of only two songs credited entirely to Ringo. Although I have my suspicions about Octopus's Garden. I think he had a lot of help from George for that one. I think George might be responsible for everything that made that song palatable. So Don't Pass Me By, the only one that is entirely Ringo, it's dreadful. It's so there's no guitars, which is unusual for a Beatles song.
Mm.
The lyrics are very crude and make no sense at all. And the drums, the one time Ringo has an opportunity to write himself a fantastic drum solo, and it sounds like a drum kit falling down the stairs.
Yeah.
He should be ashamed of himself. Then the final and most insulting thing, the rest of the Beatles, John and Paul especially, they were very good at writing songs quickly. Not only were they great songs, they used to come up with them overnight. Ringo had apparently been working on Don't Pass Me By for 5 years.
Yeah, there's an interview on one of the BBC shows where he's sort of saying, yeah, I've written this new song, and it's bloody great. And, 5 years later, 4 or 5 years later, and that was it.
I mean, it might well be that this is all conjecture and none of this is true. I mean, most of the knowledge I have about the Beatles and their recordings and their songs is from this book by Ian McNaughton, Revolution in the Head. And I've seen interviews with Paul McCartney where he says, oh, that's all nonsense. None of that book's true. So I don't know what to believe.
That's a deeper question, isn't it? That's a whole new podcast.
Well, yes. That's for another podcast.
It is. Track 2, Eleanor Rigby.
Yes, it's a lovely song, isn't it?
What a song.
And they chose to release this one as the single, despite the fact that there's no guitars. It's a string quartet, and it's about death.
It is.
But it so happens, even though it's not the stuff of Top of the Pops, it's just a brilliant song. It's a real tearjerker, and it sounds like the violins from Psycho. Although there is one thing about that song that annoys me. If you listen very, very carefully to the original stereo version, which until 2009 was the version that everyone knew and that everyone had, the very first syllable, when he says L from Eleanor Rigby, he forgot to turn down the ADT. There's two of him, only for the word L. And then the rest of it, Eleanor Rigby, there's only one of him. But it's, now that I've pointed it out, you're going to hear it every time. Eleanor Rigby
picks up the rice in the... Donovan was involved in a few songs on this album, but according to Donovan, I'm not sure I believe this, but he said Paul McCartney rolled up at his door one day, said, I've written this song called Ola Na Tungi. Ola Na Tungi, blowing his mind in the dark with a pipe full of clay, no one can say.
That sounds a lot like a Paul McCartney lyric. It's quite believable.
Really?
There's a meme going around the internet where people, they write little poems or little songs, I don't know what you call them, to the tune of the first bit of Eleanor Rigby. It's doing the rounds on, because it usually perfectly matches 140 characters. So that's why it's a thing. And it sounds like Paul was playing that game even before Eleanor Rigby was finished.
The Beatles foresaw Twitter in 1966. Is that what you're saying? Unbelievable.
You might be aware I have a song in my live act that I sometimes do called I'm Glad John Lennon Died. Now, it's tongue-in-cheek. I don't really mean that, of course. But the song explores what would have happened to John Lennon's legacy if he had survived into his 40s and 50s and so on. You know, would he be the legend that he's remembered as today, or would he have embarrassed himself in middle age?
Interesting. Could we possibly have a little snippet?
Yeah, you can either take it from the YouTube video or I can play it for you now. Would you like a live version?
I would love a live version. That'd be awesome.
What if John Lennon was still alive today and he had not been shot? The general consensus is that that would be nice, but I dare to say that it might not. He'd hang around with Geldof doing Live Aid anchor like, oh, I'm glad John Lennon died. Now, before you start to boo me and say that I'm a twat, perhaps I should explain. He last wrote a good song in 1971, and he never sang a decent one again. His music in the 80s would have sounded like Crowded House. Oh, I'm glad John Lennon died. And here's a thought, imagine if he made a guest appearance as a panelist on Never Mind the Buzzcocks. All his contributions would be painfully bad, and to see him look so past it would be really sad. He'd always be on Twitter making really racist jokes. Oh, I'm glad John Lennon died. Imagine if he, instead of Neil Buchanan, presented Art Attack. Oh, I'm glad John Lennon died. And by the way, I wonder, did you ever stop to think about whatever would have happened to McCartney? Everyone would still be saying Paul is dead, and they would have named the airport after him instead. In 1990, Yoko would have killed him anyway. Oh, I'm glad John Lennon died.
Lovely.
Thank you very much. I have to play that song in Liverpool next week.
Oh, yeah, good luck. It's been nice knowing you. This could be like a tribute.
So, yeah, that's my thoughts on John Lennon's legacy.
Absolutely. Well, Rob Manuel was mentioning Lennon on Twitter would have been a night. It would similar to Morrissey, I think, is the kind of comparison.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you've just reminded me and made me sad.
Oh, we have
there's
the memories.
There's another work I can't quite listen to the same again. But that's for another podcast.
That's for another one. That's volume three.
Yeah.
That was brilliant. Wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm only sleeping. John Bone Idol having a nap in Super ADT. What do you think?
Yeah, a thing I heard was that in 1966 they did a poll of what are your favourite songs on the new Beatles album, Revolver, and a list came out which put I'm Only Sleeping second from bottom, second only to Tomorrow Never Knows. It wasn't popular at the time, but they, interestingly, they did the same survey again 30 years later. In 1996, for the an anniversary, the list was almost completely inverted.
Mm.
So John's songs, it seems, were ahead of their time, and they were growers. I mean, I love I'm Only Sleeping, especially because I was familiar with the version on Anthology, which was a couple of tinny acoustic guitars, slightly different harmonies and a bit faster. And I was very familiar with that. And then I heard the studio version on Revolver, and wow. What an improvement. I love both versions, but, you know, when you hear one and you're used to the other, the extra, that's good.
There's another version on that Anthology, just a brief snippet of, with a, is it Glockenspieler or xylophone?
Yeah, it sounds like an electric piano.
Yeah.
And that sounds like incidental music.
It does. Sounds like something from Smile or Pet Sounds or something like
that. Yeah, it does. And it's quite, it suits the subject matter of the song, because it's very dreamy sounding, but I think they did well not to use it.
Yeah.
It was a bit silly, even for the Beatles.
Even for them.
Have you heard the version from 1996 by Suggs?
Yes.
It's bad. Let's not talk about it anymore.
Ever again. That's for another podcast.
Yeah.
Why did he do it? Why?
I think he did it because he wanted to remind everyone how good the original was. So I felt like that when I saw the live-action version of Beauty and the Beast. I was like, well, this film's fine, but just the original's better. It doesn't have all the extra bits that weren't needed. And it's a cartoon.
George, for the first time on a Beatles album, they had three tracks on an album. And I think I'm Only Sleeping is a bit of a clue, because John's output was diminishing rapidly at this time.
He was stoned.
He was a bit. Just a bit.
I listened to Revolver last night, trying to imagine what it must have been like if you were a teenager in the 60s and you didn't know what was coming. Like, trying to hear the songs as if for the first time. must have totally blown them away. They must have thought, well, what are they doing? Has my record broken? Have they given me a defective one? Because this surely isn't the Beatles. But that's what made the Beatles great, is that they used their enormous power and influence to experiment. They got away with things that other bands wouldn't have been able to get away with. You know, like taking a risk, like putting a song that sounds very Indian indeed, trying to sell it to a bunch of Western teenagers, and it got people interested in world music.
Absolutely. The lyric, that jumps out at me is the make love all day long, make love singing songs. And I tried this with Yakety Sax, the Benny Hill theme.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't work.
Well, I'm now sitting there imagining that. I wonder if that's what they meant, because the Beatles often with their lyrics, they didn't used to literally mean everything they sang. There was a lot of symbolism and hidden meaning.
Mm.
And perhaps make love singing songs.
What song would you sing, Jay?
During the act?
Yeah.
Theme from Dad's Army, I think. Give everyone a few more minutes. Anyway.
Mr. Foreman's on the run.
Anyway, moving swiftly on.
And it was George had problems with song titles at this time. He just seemed to pick Apple names. So this one was Granny Smith.
Oh, yeah. And also, the title they eventually went with, Love You Too, there's a couple of things wrong with that. First of all, those words don't appear in the song, and that's a little bugbear of mine. I always find it a little irritating when a song is given a title that isn't sung. Mm. It sounds a bit pretentious. But also, how's he spelling love you too? If it's spelled T-double-O, as in I also love you too, that's a good name for a love song. But he spelled it love you too, as in T-O. Like, what is that? Is that a split infinitive, or is that going towards something? Or is it, what's it supposed to mean? Or can he just not spell?
I would love you to, what?
Yeah, maybe that's what it means.
Make love singing songs.
No, I've never thought of that interpretation before. Love you to, as in I want you to do something. But it's still a bad title.
I know. I would have gone for Granny Smith myself.
Well, they weren't good at naming things. The White Album, well, that's not the name, first of all. It was called The Beatles.
Yeah.
Which is a daft name for an album, so everyone else called it The White Album. But that was going to be called A Doll's House.
Which would have been much better.
Oh, yeah.
More appropriate for the songs.
I agree. And you surely know this one. Do you know what Abbey Road was going to be called, the album, before they called it Abbey Road?
Everest, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the story, which sounds made up, is the reason they didn't want to call it Everest is because someone suggested they go to the Himalayas for a photo shoot.
Yeah.
Screw that. Let's just do it outside.
Yeah. Well, they couldn't be bothered for Get Back. They couldn't be bothered to go and actually perform, you know, let's just go and do it on the roof. So they're not going to go to Everest, are they?
Don't often talk about how lazy the Beatles were sometimes, but there's two examples right there.
That's another podcast.
Yep.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here.
Now the only love song on the album, amazingly, Here, There and Everywhere.
This is Paul's personal favourite of his entire oeuvre, apparently. He's a big fan of Here, There and Everywhere.
And rightly so.
It's got lots of lovely key changes. And the key changes come by stealth, which is something that Paul's very good at. And this is around about the same time as Penny Lane, which has the best stealth key change in any song ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit too twee for me. I mean, I like the fact that if Paul had tried this song a bit later in his career, it would have been all orchestral with little tweeting bird sounds and it would have been cheesy as you like. But he was still not that long after Rubber Soul, and there's still some jangly guitars in there and some quiet drums, which I think brings it down to earth and makes it palatable. That's why I tolerate the song, because although it's got these wonderful harmonies and it's incredibly well written, the fact that it is still a rock song, the fact that you've still got drums and jangly guitars, makes it not quite as cheesy as it would otherwise have been.
Yeah, and I think on the album, it's surrounded by heavy electric guitars. I'm just thinking if Phil Spector had got hold of this a few years later.
He'd have long and winding roaded it. let me try that again. He'd have long and winding roaded it.
He would have long and winding roaded it.
He'd have longed and wounding roaded. That's what he would have done.
He would.
He would have made it Phil Spec terrifying.
I like it. And it's very influenced by Brian Wilson. Very influenced.
Oh, of course. Well, this was the album that was made during the war with the Beach Boys. It started with Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
Rubber Soul happened, and then Brian Wilson said, right, let me try and do better than that. And then simultaneously out came Pet Sounds and Revolver. Paul McCartney said, well, Pet Sounds is really good. I know Revolver was good, but Pet Sounds is great, so let's try and do even better than that. Mm. So they made Sgt. Pepper, and it drove Brian Wilson insane.
It did, unfortunately. Submarine.
And we were marched till 3 the day to see them gathered there. From Land of Groats to John O'Green, with Stepney do we tread. To see us yellow submarine, we love it.
Yellow Submarine. I'm guessing this could possibly be one of your, based on your Don't Pass Me By comments, one of your lesser favourites. But what are your thoughts?
Actually, no. I mean, it's not. I don't think it's in my top half favourites on the album. The thing is, this song is what it is. It's a children's song. It's almost a nursery rhyme. In fact, we used to sing this in school, in primary school, before I knew it was a Beatles song. And of all of the children's songs that the Beatles did, so that includes Yellow Submarine, All Together Now, Octopus's Garden, of all of those, this is the best one.
Absolutely.
Because there are some great harmonies in, and it's a jolly silly song.
I do like the thought of the recording session, because apparently Mal Evans was marching around the studio with a bass drum, followed by George Martin, and Brian Jones was there as well from the Stones.
Oh really?
Yeah, I didn't backing know that. Vocals.
I know that George Martin, before he worked with the Beatles, he used to produce comedy albums, and he worked with the Goons. So he was very experienced in making silly noises in that very studio.
Liam, this is rife with them, isn't it? You've got all the...
Yeah. It actually, the bit where they're all shouting out their sound effect, it sounds like a bit from the Goons, which, of course, the Beatles were fans of.
So from that, we bounce merrily along into the crunch of She Said, She Said, which is, what a song.
It contrasts very well with Yellow Submarine. The interesting thing I heard about this song, the bass part is unusually simple, and they think it's not Paul. They think it's George.
Yes, apparently. Well, this was the last song to be recorded for the album, and they had little time. They were just about to go on tour. The horrendous tours they went on in 66 in Manila and America. And
oh, yeah. Well, this was the tour to end all tours, wasn't it? Manila with the... They basically almost died. Candlestick Park. They had a miserable time on tour.
Absolutely. And it's weird to think, you know, this album has been made and then they're going out there singing rock and roll music to, you know, screaming girls. It's a strange concept.
I suppose even when they were recording Revolver, there's some fantastic studio techniques, especially Tomorrow Never Knows, but they were probably still thinking, ooh, how are we going to do this one live? There's a very, very rare performance. Like, it's there on YouTube, you can find it, of the Beatles performing Yesterday live with their instruments. Yes. Because what often happened is Paul would stand on his own, the others would run off, and there'd be a backing track. They did that on TV a couple of times, I think. But there is a version of Yesterday, which they play in the original key of G, and the whole band is playing.
Yeah,
and it's not a bad song, but it's very hard to find. And I wonder if every time they made... They were probably thinking when they were recording Eleanor Rigby, well, this will be tough. How are we going to do this with guitars? Oh, well, let's cross that bridge.
Yeah, because nothing was performed live at all from this album.
Oh, is that true?
No. The only song they did from this era was Paperback Writer, which was pretty ropey. And what they would do... When they were struggling with the harmonies, George or Paul would wave to the crowd to get them to scream, to cover up the faux pas.
I mean, the Beatles didn't put a lot of effort. And while we're on the subject of the Beatles being lazy, there are quite a few clips that the Beatles at the time probably never assumed that people would still be able to watch 50 years later, of them being frankly terrible. Yeah. And, you know, as much as I love the Beatles, I think, you know, I owe it to them to be honest. Some of their performances are really slapdash, especially around about this time, 65, 66, when their hearts are just not in it anymore.
And you can't blame them. I mean, especially the last tour is an absolute nightmare. But I think that, bear in mind, the lyrics for this were inspired from an acid trip that they took with Peter Fonda back in 1965. And it's weird to think of Help and Rubber Soul, and they were dropping acid back then. So, you know, then going out touring the world must have been terrifying for them.
It's amazing they survived it. They must have been so ill. The LSD had influence on Help, where a song like Ticket to Ride has a drone. Now that's the sort of thing that only someone who's on drugs would think of doing. But then less than 2 years later, and they're wearing their drugs on their sleeve
and up their nose.
No, they weren't doing anything with their noses around that time, were they?
I don't know. I think anything goes, wasn't it, at that time?
Well, yeah. Okay. It's a great song, she said. I think that goes on the list of songs that weren't appreciated too much at the time, but people love it now.
It'd be nice to hear if Giles Martin continues with his remixing to get this in a full stereo version, because it's with the drums on one side, it's not quite as powerful.
Yeah.
He'll do it.
That's the unfortunate thing about the Beatles albums, is that when they were released on CD in 1987, the version that became basically the official Beatles was the first attempt at mixing in stereo, which in the 60s very few people had. So it wasn't done very well, and often the Beatles weren't even in the room when it was being mixed, and that's why Sgt. Pepper, they only fixed this in, there's either 2009 or 2016, depending on which version you think is the better one. But right up until then, if you listen to Sgt. Pepper on headphones, it hurts your ears.
Yeah.
For the songs, you've got all of the instruments on the left and all the vocals on the right. It's horrible.
It is. It's like having your ears stretched.
Yeah. But they fixed it now. And then the recent remastering of Sgt. Pepper. Oh, what a treat.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? That was, for me, just a amazing. Because Giles Martin has found this demixing technique. So all the songs that were bounced onto one track, he's now isolating the drums and the bass and the hi-hat, whatever. So you've got a full stereo picture, but he's made it so powerful.
It's amazing what they can do. I mean, some of the decisions I don't quite agree with, but, you know, the originals are still there. One thing I'm not sure if I like or not, in the song Fixing a Hole, about halfway through, Paul makes a mistake on his bass line, and Giles decided to correct it.
Oh, no.
It's quite as good.
No.
The mistake had character. Also, the song Fixing a Hole, it gradually speeds up. You know, is he going to decide to digitally put a metronome on it? I think that the next logical step, or I suppose the ultimate, the final Beatles release before there really is nothing to scrape from the barrel, is every track from every take ever. So that you can be your own George Martin in your own home. That's surely, once they do, if they ever do release that, which would probably be after it falls out of copyright, There really is nothing else to do. That really would be the end of the Beatles trying to re-release things. Do you know, we're very nearly at the point where the anthology is as long ago as the Beatles breaking up was before the anthology.
Oh, that's painful. Really?
Yeah. Free as a Bird is very nearly as old as The Long and Winding Road was when Free as a Bird came out.
Wow, that's not good.
But it's still a year and a half away, so let's not feel old. Let's make the most of it while we can.
Let's revel in the sunshine by turning over to side two.
And, oh, nice.
Oh, I could be on Radio 2 with this sort of material. and one thing I noticed about this, it reminds me, swivelling over the side two of Abbey Road, both songs about sunshine and Here Comes the Sun and Good Day Sunshine. It's a nice little refreshing satsuma.
I wonder if they did that on purpose. I wonder if they decided side two should begin with a sunshiny song, because they did it more than once.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. I need to laugh, and when the sun is out, I've got something I can laugh about. I feel good in a special way. I'm in love and it's a sunny day. Good day, sunshine.
Paul McCartney's songs at this time, a lot of them, so if you include Good Day Sunshine, Penny Lane, Getting Better, Fixing a Hole, they sound like they were written on the piano because the beat is on the crotch. It's on the boom, 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 like that. That spawned a genre as well.
So this was written at John's house in Kenwood. Again, similar to Here Comes the Sun, written with George and Eric Clapton around his house on a sunny day.
They wrote about what was around them at the time.
Very inspired by Daydream, I think, by the Loving Spoonful. Similar chords.
I don't know that song. I'll have to go and research it.
What a day for a daydream.
Oh, that? Oh, of course. Do, 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 do. Oh, absolutely, yeah, very similar. See, the Beatles weren't only lazy, they were thieves. I also like it sounds like it's got an unusual time signature, like it changes into 6 and goes back to 2 and 4. It doesn't, it's in 4-4. It just sort of does some unexpected things.
It does. Talking of unexpected things, you can do unexpected things with Beatles songs.
Ah, are you referring to my one syllable out of sync trick?
I am.
All right, well, what I usually do... Right, so this is part of my live act. I ask the audience to name a song, usually a Beatles song, and I sing it with... I sing the first syllable twice, and it means that from that point on, the lyrics and the melody are out of sync with each other. So I'll do a demonstration. If you name for me a track from Revolver, and I'll do my trick. I've got my guitar.
Okay, well, should we go with Yellow Submarine?
Okay. In an town where I was born, lived a man who sailed to sea, and he told us of his life in the land of submarine. So we sailed upon. I've just realised I've accidentally gone 2 syllables out of sync, but the effect is much the same.
How about the chorus? How would that go?
We all live in a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine. We all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine. And our friends are all aboard, many more of them live next, and so on and so on.
This, they would have been super lyrics for one of George's songs. Reen submarine. Oh, that is genius. How do you do that?
Well, the way I do it, my head splits into 2. Half of me is listening out for the melody and what to do with my fingers for the guitar, and the other half is listening out for the lyrics. And I don't know what the end result's going to sound like until it comes out. While I'm doing that, I find it very hard to concentrate on yet a third thing. It's like when you get a computer to do 2 things at once and it crashes. That's what it does to my brain.
Yeah. Never do that when you're driving, please.
Oh, no, no.
And Your Bird Can Sing.
This is a great song, isn't it?
What a song.
Right, moving on to... what's to be said about And Your Bird Can Sing? There's a version of it on the anthology where they're pissing themselves laughing. It just sounds so infectious. And that version sounds like they're copying The Birds.
Very much so, yeah.
But the version that ends up on Revolver, the guitar part's so good, I wonder if it's not 2 guitars.
It is. It's Paul and George.
Oh, really?
Playing.
They sound a bit like a Thin Lizzy. That's it. Sounds like it could have been a Thin Lizzy thing. Well, you know, Thin Lizzy have got 2 lead guitars, often just like playing in harmony with each other.
Yeah.
They're doing similar. That.
So the Beatles invented Thin Lizzy and Twitter.
Yes. But that was nothing else.
Nothing else. There was no other influence anywhere. Yeah. Ringo's drums on this, very underrated drummer, but on this he's just powering. You think of the beginning, it's bam, straight in there.
Yeah, a good piece of advice for people who are Beatles fans but they think they might be a bit bored of the Beatles. I've done this, go back and listen to it all again, but listen out only for the drums. And if you've not paid attention to them before, as many people don't, you're in for a treat. Ringo's really good. Because you'll often hear people saying that he wasn't a great drummer, but... You'll never hear a drummer say that.
No. This apparently was Beatles-Stones rivalry. Apparently the bird in the title is referencing Marianne Faithfull.
Really? Going out.
supposedly, this is one of those rumours.
I mean, these rumours are just too easy to make up. It sounds quite plausible that it's true, but again, it could be so easy to make up. Like, for example, we were talking about Eleanor Rigby. It is apparently based on the actress Eleanor Brom, who was acting with the Beatles in the film Help. But that sounds to me like it's just too easy to make up. A bit like the famous fact that John Cleese named Basil Fawlty after the fact that he used to live in Basil Street in Kensington. And that's simply not true. And he's refuted this himself many, many times. But people love to spot a coincidence. You used to live in Basil Street at the time you were writing Fawlty Towers. Well, that's obviously where you got the name, in much the same way that the name Eleanor Rigby must have come from Eleanor Brom. Not necessarily. Marianne Faithfull, who knows? Did the Beatles ever do a song about a Mars bar?
No. Apparently that's not true either. That really.
Oh, really? Only two people know what really happened, and one of them is a Mars bar.
Absolutely. I think a lot of the problem with a lot of the Beatles legends on their legacy is that Lennon was a bit of a stirrer, and he was mainly where these sort of first stories came from, and then he'd deny them 3 seconds later. So
yeah, he often contradicted himself, and it means that you start to wonder if so. Probably the most famous one of all is he insists that Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is nothing to do with LSD. It's just a coincidence because his son drew that picture. I wonder if, despite the fact that Julian's picture, which we all know is real because we've seen it, despite that, did he know exactly what he was doing?
Yeah, I would say he did know. Although the rest of the Beatles backed him up, didn't they? They said, no, it's definitely not about that.
And they do to this day. Of course, when I say they, we're now talking about it's only Paul and Ringo.
It is, yeah.
And Ringo, I mean, do you follow Ringo Starr on Twitter?
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. I love his Twitter feed. It's like, I've said this before, but it's like getting a text from your mum. He can't spell. He ends every single tweet. We know it's him, but he ends every single tweet with peace and love and the letter R for Ringo. How sweet.
I did do a while ago on YouTube. I don't know if it's still there, actually, but overdubbed his. Do you remember his rant about stop sending?
Oh, yeah. It's going to be tossed.
Yeah, I overdubbed that on a Thomas the Tank. So stop sending me rubbish, said Thomas. But, anyway, I'm not sure if it's still there. Have a look anyway.
Have you seen Ringo did a lot of adverts in the 80s?
Oh, yeah, have you seen them? I think he did some in Japan primarily, didn't he?
He did. I mean, again,
simple life.
Surely, does he need the money? Was he just bored? Do you need something to get out of the house for?
Well, he was. There was an interview with him talking about Pepper, and he was basically used for the drum, a few congas, and then he wasn't really needed for the other 6 months, so he learnt chess and just did nothing.
And he started writing a song. So this is 1967. He probably started working on a song for his solo career that got released in 2008.
Well, I suspect he was still working on "Don't Pass Me By."
Do you need me?
Verse two.
No, we don't need you, Ringo. You can go carry on working on Don't Pass Me By. Oh, thanks, lads.
Bloody that's fantastic. Nice.
I did another syllable.
But we do love Ringo.
We do. And he was a very good drummer. And a left-handed drummer playing right-handed drums, which sounds unique. Which is a story for another podcast.
That is. We mentioned that, actually. Ben Wheatley was talking about it. He couldn't get the concept of a left-handed drummer. And he was going, are the drums strapped to the ceiling? Or...
He lies on his back and he drums with his feet, smashing the bass drum with his head.
Your day breaks, your mind aches. You find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up. She takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years.
For no one. What a song this is.
That's another love song. You said there was only one. That's two.
Is it a love song or is it a
it's a lovesick song. I mean, it's if we put it in the category of what the Beatles had decided for the first time not to do with Nowhere Man, then this song falls into that category. It's about love and loss. Basically, it's about a lady. I assume it's about Jane Asher. It sounds like a waltz. It sounds like a waltz, but it's in 4/4.
I've read somewhere it's not about Jane Asher.
Oh.
Which could add some extra elements to this.
Another thing that's very Paul McCartney, is very similar to Fool on the Hill, where the verse is in a major key, but the chorus is in a minor key.
Mm. As a musician, do you find it's the music that draws you to the Beatles, or the lyrics, or...?
It's certainly the music more than the lyrics, because people say great things about the Beatles. They talk about their songwriting, their harmonies, their studio direction, their personalities. Very, very few people talk about their lyrics, because they weren't great.
No.
They used to love not caring about it. So like John's lyrics especially, you look at the lyrics of Strawberry Fields, there's nothing clever in there at all. And if you try to search for the meaning and let's see, what did he really mean? There's nothing there. People will, they'll find meaning in what, well, you know, we know well, people will find meaning in things if they look hard enough. Doesn't mean it's what was intended.
No, and again, I did think there's that, what was the Imagine film where somebody escape or somebody jumps into John's garden.
Oh, yeah, that's a scary moment.
Yeah, and as you do, John invites him in for a meal.
Yeah, but the cameras were on. Maybe normally he'd spray him with the hose, but because the cameras are there, he's like, oh, come in, have some toast. Yoko, make him some toast.
Yeah, Phil Spector with his machine gunner hanging out the window.
I always knew it was a bad
one. The bloke was saying, yeah, the lyrics to, what was it from Let It Be?
It was a really obscure one. It was something from Abbey Road. He says, it was a Dig a Pony.
Dig a Pony.
Saying, oh, but you know, you were talking about me. And John's like, no, I wasn't. Barely even talking about myself.
I was in bed.
Yeah.
It's difficult though, isn't it? They were so good. It's difficult not to...
Well, I think part of being a Beatles fan, like, I mean, you sound like one. Beatles
Thanks.
Fans, like we are, I think we are entitled to have our opinions about how they were sometimes not great. Because they weren't perfect, they were just... I mean, I do believe that they were the best band in the world. I do believe that. But I also believe that they're overrated, and I also believe that they were capable of some real bollocks when they wanted to.
And I would still buy it.
Yeah.
There lies the problem. Dr. Robert.
This is a great song. Not very memorable. It's all right, I suppose. I'm trying to think, what can we say about Dr. Robert? Other than the lyrics, it's about a drug dealer, I assume. Yeah. Lots of guitars all at once. And the song, here's an opinion about the song Dr. Robert that I've got for you. I think it fades out a bit too soon. If you listen very carefully to the quiet bit, it's actually got a nice ending in there that they didn't need to fade out. If indeed they are going to fade out a song, then it should just repeat boringly. But what Dr. Robert does is it fades out as if it's about to keep repeating. But then if you listen very carefully, it's got an ending that just goes very quiet.
Yeah, and it's lovely. It's just a nice little conclusion. Ding, 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 ding.
Can you, with your sound editing powers, I know it might sound like there's a lot of hiss on it, but could you recreate the ending as it should have been by turning the volume up?
I shall have a go. I shall do it.
I bet it would sound great, although a bit hissy, but go for it.
Yeah,
in fact,
I should do
it. If you find the remastered version, it might not sound that hissy at all.
Here we go, ladies and gents. This is it.
Oh, that's great. I enjoyed that. I really heard it pretty good. And now, here's the alternative version for if that doesn't work. Oh, what were you thinking? That was awful. Turns out they were right to fade it out.
You've done this before.
I have.
But there's... I don't know if you ever saw the American TV, the Beatles cartoons.
Yes, seriously. I have. I've been working my way through them. They are terrible.
Yeah,
they were the reason that the Beatles didn't want to do their own voices in Yellow Submarine, because they'd seen that cartoon and gone, no, we're not doing cartoons. And maybe if it weren't for that cartoon, they might have said yes to Walt Disney and done the voices of the vultures in the Jungle Book, because they were asked.
They were, yeah.
And they said no because, well, you know, they'd seen cartoons. And they're like, well, we're not in favour of this. It's rubbish.
That would have been awful, though, if they'd... But the voices on the vultures aren't dissimilar to the ones in the Beatles cartoon, are they?
No. Well, again, I think Americans trying to be... I mean, Americans can't really do any British accent other than posh English. Have you ever seen... There's an episode of Frasier where we meet Daphne's family, and they're all supposed to be her brothers... And yet they've got accents from all over the British Isles.
Yeah. There was a certain ambiguity about the English accent in Frasier, I found.
Yeah. Jeeves, you know, she's British. And her Manchester accent's not Manchester.
No, it's gone through some sort of Thunderbirds filter.
I mean, it's going on the growing list of other podcasts we're going to have to do, but we've got to do one about that.
Yeah. It's if Coronation Street was set in Dallas.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, the Beatles cartoon, they, of course, Revolver was released, and they started putting these songs in for these little kids to watch. And it's bizarre, their interpretation. I remember Tomorrow Never Knows, which we're coming to shortly. It was just very bizarre. It was like an episode of, Yogi Bear. Suddenly you've got Tomorrow Never Knows playing in the background.
Like, they'd mind all of the, when the cartoon was first being made, they were thinking of songs like She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand, and it matched the style. And then they were minding their mid to late career. Doesn't go well with the cartoon. I saw one for Penny Lane, and it's like a very cheap animation cycle they've got that they use over and over and over again, with John and Paul strumming their guitars in rhythm. But they're strumming guitars playing the piano on Penny Lane.
Yeah. That's fine, it's kids. Kids won't understand.
Yeah.
I want to tell you, this is George's unprecedented third song on a Beatle album.
This is my least favourite song on the album.
Ah, interesting.
Because it's trying to be jaunty and unusual and memorable with those weird little key changes. It doesn't work too well. And then also, I'm sorry to say that the piano part that goes da-da-da-da-da-da during the chorus, it's just irritating.
It grates.
It does a bit. But I have to say, I mean, even though that's my least favourite song on the album, it's still a great song. Also, I don't like For No One much either. That can probably go.
All right. So Paperback and Rainer in.
Oh, yeah.
I think the opening of this song promises a lot more than it delivers.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's a really... I love the intro. It's a fade-in, which is unusual. The drums sound great. The riff sounds promising, and then it doesn't really do anything. And then... It's sort of, you have to know the rules about music and counting before you can break them. And I know George knows the rules, but he doesn't break them very well. It's sort of, you know, you hear the chorus jumping out at you when you least expect it. And just sometimes you don't want it to. Just sometimes those rules are there for a reason. And Western music sounds the way it does because it's good.
And again, another song that was originally a Laxton's Superb. Another apple.
What did you say? Laxton's Superb.
That was the original title.
What does another that mean?
Name. It's another name for an apple, Granny Smith or a Laxton's Superb.
Was he trying to be funny?
Yeah.
I think he was.
He was. The fact there are three songs on here from George says a lot about John's limiting his input into new songs. So I think if you count how many songs he released in 66 and 67... there's less than he did in 65 or something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Sgt. Pepper especially, like, John is quite lacking on that album. He does way, way less than half. Because usually you would try to alternate John Paul on an album. But Sgt. Pepper is mostly Paul. Paul, John, Paul.
George.
George, yeah.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind there. Ooh, then I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life?
Got to get you into my life.
Suddenly we're
bouncing into Motown with augmentation, big time.
Yeah, the brass section sounds fantastic, and you realize just how needed that brass section is when you listen to the version on Anthology that doesn't have the brass, and it lifts it so much. It's such a great song, and my favorite moment of that song might be my favorite moment on the whole album, which is near the end. It's about 2.5 minutes in, you've been enjoying the song, you've had a lovely horn section, and then, just to wake you up and remind you, it's still the Beatles, in comes George, with a little riff, while the brass band is still ringing in the background. It's great.
It is. It's like a burst of Revolver sunshine through a Motown cloud.
Yeah.
How awful was that? It is.
You're
what
calling
is
Motown a cloud?
Leave it there. And he had a couple of members of Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames played on the brass section. But it's a complete new, complete jump into the unknown for the Beatles.
Well, I see. Have they used any brass before? I don't think so.
No. Only as in the French horn solo in For No One, but not for...
Yeah, but that was only like 3.5 minutes before.
So, okay, yeah, they had. But I think they only did it again, they did it on Good Morning, Good Morning. With Sounds Incorporated, that was a good old funky sound.
Well, once we're into Pepper era, all bets are off. They start using all sorts.
Do you remember Earth, Wind and Fire covering this?
No, I don't. Let's have a little listen.
Here we go. Oh, that shit. I might not even play that. It's it is what it is. I think that was on the famous Sergeant Pepper movie the Bee Gees made.
Oh dear! Do you have a least favourite Beatles cover?
Oh, blimey!
Because there's a lot of great contenders for this.
I think my least one, Wet's version of With a Little Help from My Friends.
Oh dear.
With the ending, My Friends.
There's one in my mind. It's again from the Sergeant Pepper movie from the late 70s. George Burns singing Fixing a Hole.
Yes.
Yes. He's slightly out of time for the whole song.
And
I can't hate it. It's too funny. It's too awful.
Do you think he was into it? Do you think he thought, that's fine?
I don't think he cared. I don't think he turned up for the job. Because they told it's a Hollywood movie version of the greatest album of all time that's now 10 years old. Can you believe it? Well, obviously, yes, and it's got, stars of the day. And it was so bad that we've forgotten about it. People don't talk about it. It's hard to find a copy.
No, I know. Yeah, they're actually... Cult is one of the words I'd use.
I've only watched it in 10-minute installments on YouTube, and I can barely get through a single one of those 10-minute segments.
End with Tomorrow Never Knows, which, oddly enough, was the first song to be recorded for the album.
It's a bit like when you're cleaning the house, you get the hardest bit out of the way first, and then you'll enjoy the rest of your day. So the Beatles must have taken that attitude, like, okay, let's have the one that's by far the hardest work, let's get the weirdest one out of the way, let's be really experimental. Whew, that was fun, lads. Right, now let's record some slightly more normal songs. But, this song spawned the Chemical Brothers.
Yes,
and it sounds very, very, very similar to Let Forever Be and Setting Sun.
Absolutely.
Of course, they didn't have drum machines. That's Ringo. He's playing throughout. And all of those little weird sounds you can hear, as you surely know well, it was done with real physical tape loops that they had to stick pencils in the around the studio for.
Mm. There was dozens of them just standing around. So effectively, it was a live sampler.
Yeah, that's the incredible thing, is that when you listen to a Beatles record, there were no computers in those days, and everything you hear was happening. You know, even if it involved turning faders up and down with pre-recorded tape loops, it was no... There was no editing, as we understand editing today. It all happened. And the person who's explained this better than anyone else is... Have you ever heard of the comedian Mitch Benn?
Yes.
He's amazing. He had this routine. He had a show at the Fringe a few years ago called I Am the 37th Beatle. And he had a routine where he explained how they recorded Tomorrow Never Knows. And he does it using this live looper on his phone. And you realize just how great it sounds. So I suggest you talk to him. He's very good.
Yeah, they all had their little personal studios, didn't they? And they were all into making loops. But I think Paul was the one behind doing all of these bizarre... Again, they used the loop on the end of Sergeant Pepper, didn't they? With the, I never could see any of them.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was just no limits. You think 3 years ago they were recording She Loves You. And
yeah, it's incredible to think, because... you often think of the Beatles' career. So this is another thing that Mitch Benn has pointed out, where the beginning of the Beatles' career is all very stiff and, you know, stiff collars and black and white and neat haircuts. It feels like it's just a few minutes after the end of the Second World War. And by the end of the Beatles' career, it's 1970, everything's in color, everyone's wearing frilly, colorful clothes, and everyone's having drugs. It feels like a lifetime from one to the other. And it was only 8 years. 8 years ago was 2010. Was the world that different in 2010? So I am holding in my hand a 12-inch vinyl record, a proper LP of Revolver that I got from my parents. And I've said to my parents they can have their entire record collection back just as soon as they get a replacement record player. But in the meantime, I've got the record player, so I'm looking after their albums. And here it is. And it's a pity it's in black and white, because it means that people don't like to stare at it or remember it quite as fondly as Sgt. Pepper. But there is a lot of detail on here.
Klaus Voormann was very inspired by Aubrey Beardsley, who was a sort of pen and ink artist. He also appeared on the Pepper cover, one of his cutouts. You can sit there for hours just sort of meandering through the, you know, picking through all the photos and following the lines
this is,
of hair.
Right now, this is the most I have stared at this album cover ever. And I'm only noticing the details now. So I recognize now for the first time that there are some cutouts from the previous album cover. Like the top left is... You know, that's taken from the back of Rubber Soul.
Klaus Voormann's on there.
He's put his signature in, but where's Klaus himself?
I haven't got it in front of me. It's on the right-hand side, just above his signature. There's a tiny little head.
Oh, there he is. Yeah, that's just underneath his... I never spotted that before.
Yeah, that's the man himself.
Oh, there he is. Yeah, and I think Klaus Voormann was the guy who told them to get those mop-top haircuts in the early 60s.
Yeah, way back from the Hamburg days and moving on. You know, he worked with him through solo years. But he did the album cover, and apparently there was the original version had a picture of Paul McCartney sitting on the toilet. but George Martin was a bit offended and said, no, we can't have that.
Oh, dear. Also, this was the last Beatles album that insisted on having the name of the logo of the record label, Parlophone, on the front.
Yes.
So from Sgt. Pepper onwards, it was a blank slate. They could do whatever they wanted. It was very creative. And here's a sort of half and half where they've got some interesting artwork, but they've still got the record label logo. And then before then, every album had to have stereo or mono or, you know, Parlophone, EMI. Yeah. And, you know, Please Please Me even had little text saying, with Love Me Do and many more songs.
Yes, yeah. Overall, then, what are your overall thoughts?
Well, let's see. I must confess, my favourite Beatles album is actually Pepper. But someone's nabbed it already. And Revolver comes a very honourable, very close second for its experimentation. The fact that not only are they trying new things and it was like nothing before, but it was very accessible pop music and it's got memorable songs. And even though I was bad-mouthing a couple of songs on it, they're all great songs, and the album would be poorer if any of those songs were missing. And it's often overlooked. I feel about Revolver the same way I feel about The Bends by Radiohead, which is just because it came immediately before a much, much more successful, more famous album, doesn't mean that it's fair for it to be forgotten. So I'm comparing The Bends to OK Computer. I'm comparing Revolver to Sgt. Pepper. But Revolver, just like The Bends, is a fantastic album, and it should not be overlooked. And I was overjoyed that it hadn't been taken on the podcast before I came along.
Same here. Jay, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was fantastic.
Thank you for letting me geek out about the Beatles for ages.
Oh, absolutely. It's what we're here for. It's what we're here for. We're a service.
Incidentally, if you're listening to the podcast and you want to find out more about my stuff, is it all right to do a shameless plug?
Yeah, I was going to do it anyway, but yeah, go for
thanks.
It.
Oh, thanks. Well, basically, go to my website, which is jforman.co.uk. I've got tour dates on there. It's currently a kid's show, but you don't have to be a kid to come to the show. It's basically the same as my regular show, just with the swearing taken out. And I've also got a YouTube channel. Just search the name Jay Foreman and see what you get.
Jay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Peace and love.